This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I have the pleasure of talking to Mark Burstein, who is the editor of a large collection of material that is called The Annotated Alice. And I'm sort of stumbling a little bit because there is so much information on the cover of this book, it's hard to know where to start. It's the 150th anniversary deluxe edition, written, of course, by Lewis Carroll, originally edited by Martin Gardner, well-known editor and writer, but now expanded and updated by Mark Burstein. So it's good to talk to you, Mark.
Good to talk to you, David. Yes, this, I think Martin deserves credit as editor of this. He also contributed maybe half the updated annotations since the last edition of his book came out. So I'm the under editor, if you will, and art director. We put in a large number of images into this particular one. You want me to back up and talk a little about The Annotated Alice?
Well, I think the history, I really wanted to talk to you about the art, but we'll save that. I think the history of this edition was really interesting to me. I mean, you get into then, therefore, the history of Lewis Carroll scholarship and the way Alice has become part of the literary canon to a large extent, I think, because of Martin Gardner. So maybe it would be good to talk about him and where this all began.
No, I think that's very true. Before Gardner, this came out originally in 1960. And before that, Carroll was sort of looked down upon as a children's author and was not studied at all in academia. There's something called a Guide to Victorian Fiction. He wasn't even mentioned. And then after Gardner showed to the world, I mean, you pick up an annotated book and you think, well, he's going to explain to us what a cucumber frame is. Well, it's a lot more than that because he shows the depth of the writing. There's a lot of philosophy and mathematics and paradoxes. And, he just showed you that the book is a lot more than, a silly little children's tale.
Which it was dismissed. So then, I mean, the reason it was not included in the canon, essentially, was that it was dismissed as children's literature.
Exactly. And he showed that it wasn't, that the adults who were reading it were onto something. And the thing is that he never stopped revising it. Even back, in his day, which was, pre-internet and everything else, he sort of believed in crowdsourcing. People would constantly write to him and say, I just noticed this, I just read this, and he would put it in. So there are officially three editions of it, one called The Annotated Alice, one called More Annotated Alice, came out in 93, and one called The Definitive Edition that came out in 1999. But all of those within them, every time he saw something, he would ask the publisher to include some new notes. So that's essentially what happened, and then he passed away in 2010. And yet, between what he had done a number of annotations for our magazine, the Lewis Carroll Society of North America's magazine called Night Letter, did a number of annotations for that over the years, and between that and a lot of other scholarship that's come in the last 15 years. I guess Norton asked his son, Jim Gardner, who would be good to update this. And my name came up. I was the editor of the Night Letter and the one to whom Martin always sent his annotations. And, I'm a book editor by trade, so that was kind of a natural. So I'm very humble. Martin has always been a huge idol of mine, not only for his literary works, but he was, the mathematical games columnist of Scientific American for many years. And I loved his math, and when he passed away, I actually did a book on him called A Bouquet for the Gardener, Martin Gardner Remembered. So stepping into my idol's shoes has been a humbling ask.
Oh, I think to be fair, those are big shoes to fill.
Big shoes.
He wrote 100 books. I remember seeing him in his books in bookstores, and I probably read, I don't even remember how many, but you know, he was pretty, he was like a Renaissance man in a lot of ways.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, ironically, he never took a math course in college. He's known for that. He just had one of these incredible brains that would absorb everything, understand things, and be very articulate about, you know, pushing that into the world.
Well, and do you think his interest in Alice and Lewis Carroll is connected to his interest in mathematics? Is that what kind of generated the depth of his connection, or the depth of his interest in really studying the text?
I think it really informed that. He has talked about it, and he said actually he wasn't really fond of Alice as a child. He was much more an Oz person. And then when he was offered a contract to do this, he got into it, and then more into it, and you know, I think that is probably his best known work. It sold over 1 million copies in 9 languages, and been a huge success. So,
and was it the first in the series that Norton has of annotated classics, or was this part of a series that was already?
No! This was the first,
right?
And as you mentioned, generated a whole slew of other annotated classics. I mean, he wasn't the first one to annotate a book, but the way he did it, you know, his research and his judgment and the format and everything else was pioneering, and it's been imitated many times since.
And what's striking, I think, is that it's annotation, but not scholarly. I mean, it has scholarliness about it, but it's meant to open the text rather than to prove how smart the annotator is, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely, yes. And often he does get into something scholarly. He'll do a few sentences and say, see such and such a periodical issue, so and so numbers, so and so. So you can go, you know, the scholars can go digging through it. Which I think is a great service, because it's a very readable book.
Well, you couldn't sell 1 million copies if it wasn't. I mean, truly, that, you know, you have to assume that it's something that people really like and find helpful and open. You know, again, it grows your understanding of the text.
Exactly.
I think that's important. And so, I guess, what got you interested in Lewis Carroll's writing, or in Alice? I mean, what was the genesis of your connection to this work?
I could really start the story in 1934.
when you were a 20-year-old, right?
When I was a minus 20-year.
Yeah.
Minus 24, actually, with something. No, my father fell in love with his first grade teacher, who was also an actress who played Alice in a local theater production in San Francisco, and he got very into it and wrote a number of papers in college about it, and then started collecting in the mid-70s. So we had a pretty good world-class, I'd say, Carroll collection that we put together. So it's sort of genetic in me, you know. But then I think the place I really got it, so to speak, was in college, and I was in Santa Cruz in the late 60s, which may tell you something about some of the influences on that. But I wrote a paper about Zen Buddhism in Wonderland, and then that kind of expanded into take on the number of different interpretations of the book, and that became part of my senior thesis, and blah, 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 and I've sort of never looked back. It's just been a huge part of my life, and I've either edited or introduced or contributed to, I think, 14 books on Carroll at this point, and see no reason to stop.
Well, it obviously is, it hasn't, I mean, I admit that while I have read Alice and I enjoy it, it hasn't been something that has done for me what it has happened to you, but this particular edition is really rich and has kind of changed my perspective a little bit.
Oh, well, thank you. We really feel it's the a very important one, because not only have we updated a lot of the annotations, as we said, but the fact that we've introduced 47 different illustrators to the world, because it's the most I can't say absolutely, but I do believe it's the most illustrated novel that has ever been written, the most widely illustrated. It's certainly the most quoted book of all time. It's up there with Shakespeare and the Bible in terms of citations and quotes, but I don't know any other book that has been so widely and constantly and consistently illustrated.
Well, it obviously, and I did want to talk to you about this, because the breadth of the art in this book is astonishing. And I was really taken with so many of the artists. I mean, some of them I knew and some of them who I had never seen before, but the work is just incredible. And really, you can see how it inspired artists, which is really that I think is a really powerful thing, that that these artists, so many artists, would want to interpret these scenes in their own styles and in their own ways, but the work is great.
Well, it's particularly ironic because he worked so closely with the original illustrator, John Tenniel, and they're among the most iconic images in Western civilization. I mean, you can always recognize a Tenniel Alice or a caterpillar or Humpty Dumpty. And yet, the copyright ran out in 1907. Literally thousands of illustrators have had their way, so to speak, put their own spin on Alice. I mean, part of it is that Carroll never really did any descriptions of characters. If you read the text, you just sort of we have certain pictures of them,
those pictures that are in our minds are of Tenniel's originals. Those are the ones that define them, because typically you would read Alice when you're a child, and they're very influential. You know, I think the Frank Baum books are similar, that you're vision in your mind of what those characters look like is fixed to a great extent, right, because you read them when you were young. It's like going to, maybe a movie would be the same thing. You know, there's certain movies that you saw when you were young and you'll forever believe that the character, that's the character. And then when somebody makes a later one, sometimes people don't like it, because they like the original one so much.
Right. Well, I also think it informs your reading of it. It changes the way, Ralph Steadman is one of my very favorite illustrators, the Hunter Thompson.
Yeah, mine.
And he did an incredible Alice.
I know.
Won some awards that, it captures that particularly British eccentricity and I think if that is a great one for adults. I also just put out, actually it came out today, one illustrated by Salvador Dali, that first trade edition we've done of a book that he did in the late 60s and came out in a very expensive limited edition. But, reading a book that with illustrations by a Steadman or a Dali or a Barry Moser is very different than reading something that was intended for, older children.
No, that is true. And I've noticed that. I remember the Steadman Alice, and it changes your perspective considerably, not to mention the fact that his illustrations have a particular perspective throughout, that you see a Steadman and you know that exactly who it is because he uses perspective, and it does literally change the way you see the work, I think, or see the characters in the story.
Ralph was actually very, very cooperative, and we got not only several of his pictures, without fee, but his people actually shot the original artwork for us, so they're reproduced exquisitely in the book, in the annotated.
Yeah, it's really good. Well, I also was very interested in the list of movies and television shows, and kind of exhaustive resource there. That was pretty interesting because there were some I had not heard of or seen, and some of them you kind of remember vaguely from some moment in time, but it was kind of, that was interesting too, just how many different Alices there have been over the years.
Yeah, I think they're 53 or something. You know, most people think of the Disney, but we in the Carol world regard that as a, you know, a fun Disney film, but not that related to the right. Alice. And the Burton, I like to call it a hairball, but came out in 2010, which has absolutely nothing in common with the books at all, except, you know, the name of the occasional character. But Thomas Edison did a version in 1910. There was a version in 1903. There's innumerable television and cartoon versions. Most of them are on DVD. The only one I've ever really liked is one done for the BBC in 1966, directed by Jonathan Miller and starring Peter Sellers and John Gielgud and you know, that sort of Peter Cook and that sort of genre. I mean, that sort of, you know, level of actors. Very little costuming, no special effects, all black and white, but it just captures the charm so beautifully, and it's very faithful to the book. And if it weren't for the Ravi Shankar soundtrack to be requisite in the 60s, I would consider it a pretty much perfect adaptation.
Is that one available on DVD now?
Absolutely, yes.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, another thing I wanted to ask you about is this so-called suppressed chapter. That was new. And I think, am I right in understanding that this is the first publication of it, or was that, is that language from an earlier edition? So that,
No, that was all from earlier editions. That was discovered in the, I should have my notes here, but.
Well, in 1898, it was sold, but it was discovered in 1974. Apparently when it was auctioned off, or that some galleys were auctioned off by Sotheby in London.
And then our society was the one who published it and gave it to the world. Martin Gardner was, of course, very instrumental in that. So it was a chapter that Carol had intended for Through the Looking Glass, and it went as far as being typeset and in galleys. But then... it's called The Wasp in the Wig, and Tenniel said this is, the exact quote was, beyond the appliances of art for him to draw it. And then he also said, you know, this is just not up to snuff. It's not as good as the rest of the book. And Carol finally agreed with him, and they drew the chapter out, and it was considered lost for 80, 90 years until someone found it.
And I was curious about that whole description, because there's, I mean, maybe there's no way to know, but how is it that Carol gave in to his illustrator? That struck me a little bit, that the illustrator's opinion of the writing would influence Carol to drop the entire piece. I know he was, when he was publishing this, this was originally privately published, I mean, or financed by Carol or Dodgson.
It was Macmillan never felt that it would sell, so they told Mr. Dodgson, which is Carol's real name, that he had to pay for the whole thing and he could keep the rights, which was a rather big mistake on their part. it wasn't that Tenniel dictated and said, you must remove this chapter. He just said, you know, maybe you should think about this, that it's perhaps not up to the rest of the book. And you know, Carol agreed. There was a Carol was kind of an art director. He told Tenniel, you know, what to draw, where the people were, how, you know, and so they had a sometimes strained but generally cordial relationship.
Have you read? I mean, obviously you've read it. What do you agree with the assessment that it's not up to snuff?
It's not as good. The Wasp is a caricature of sort of lower British working class. It doesn't come off as gentle as some of his other writings. I mean, I think it could have been included without, you know, terrible upset to the world, but.
Right. In other words, I think, you know, when I looked at it, I thought, well, if it had been there all along, would we have noticed? Would anyone have said, this is a weak chapter? Or maybe somebody might have, but I just wonder if it really would have been missed, if you will. No, I'm sorry. I say it the other way. If that it would have been noticeable that it was, not quite as good. I wonder.
Yeah.
About
no,
that.
I think it just would. It would have been regarded as one of the weaker chapters without any particularly memorable lines in it. But I think it could have been in there. I think it was in. I guess it must have been the definitive edition that it appeared for the first time.
Right.
In terms of the annotated.
Right. It was a little confusing as a reprint to read that because that's the language of another edition and you kind of don't know necessarily whether it's, without knowing for sure. You just don't know where it came from.
Right. I take that back. I just picked up more annotated Alice, the 93 one, and it is in there.
Got it.
That's where it's
right. So okay, I wanted to ask you a little bit about Carroll and his writing method. As I understood it, he told stories to the little girl who is Alice, essentially. And I'm just wondering, did he write these down subsequently? And was he composing did he tell the stories and then later write them, or did he write them down and then tell them?
Well, generally he would just tell them and they would go off into the ozone and never be heard of again. This particular day, the 4th of July, 1862, apparently was a particularly good story. And they're all improvised. And Alice, who was a real girl, the daughter, his boss's daughter, essentially, said, "Well, won't you write that down for me, Mr. Dodson?" And he did, presenting it to her the next Christmas as a handwritten, hand-illustrated manuscript, which she showed to some of her friends, including the daughters of George MacDonald. She said, "You've got something here. Why don't you expand it and get a real illustrator?" That's what happened. He threw in, I think, tales he had told on other days, at other times, and similar expeditions. Or he also would tell stories while he was photographing them. Of course, he was one of the first photographers, one of the better ones in Victorian England. He would, and in those days you had to keep still for 3 minutes to take a picture, and he would tell them stories. So all these were sort of floating around in his head, and he wrote them down. And but in Wonderland he had this nice structure of this one tale he had told. In Looking Glass he essentially made up the whole thing, decided to put it in a chess game. It was a much more deliberate book. And it reads that way. He called it a huge mass of literature, which he spelled L-I-T-T-E-R. And he said, little things floating around here and there that he just put together and wove a structure around.
It's interesting. Yeah. But this was all kind of in this period, in the 1860s, did he continue to, it feels like he was inspired because he was so enamored of these children that he was telling stories to, and it kind of prompted him to create this world. And obviously once the world was created and people responded to it, he continued to live in that world. But do you think that it was really all about that one particular moment and this sort of, the accident of all these things coming together, just at that one particular time?
Well, yes and no. It definitely it was sort of an epiphany for him. But he was a very creative person and a writer. He has, if you count his pamphlets, he has over 300 publications, either in the name of Carroll or Dodson. A lot of them were, Politics of Oxford or mathematical treatises. But he never stopped writing. He also had 60,000 or so letters. He loved writing letters. So he was a very driven writer. Those two, one was 1865, one was 1872, were definitely of a period. He went on 7 years later to write The Hunting of the Snark, which was one of the great, not the greatest, nonsense poems.
Yeah, yeah.
English language.
That's true.
And then towards the end of his life, he wrote this unbelievably mawkish, treacly thing called Sylvie and Bruno that I hope some fellow Carolians will forgive me, but it's just almost unreadable. it's about these brother and sister fairy, and the brother talks in baby talk, and And meanwhile, he's trying to conjure up this romance.
He loved to write. Right. Well, no, I guess the reason I thought of that is that he, you know, if you could write one great thing in your life as a writer, I think that's pretty good. And it seems that these pieces about Alice really are definitional for him, and it would be pretty difficult to continue. You know, it's just that seems really hard. It's what do you do for the second act? You know,
right?
It's pretty great stuff.
I think the Snark is defensible as his third great masterpiece. Not as well known as the Alice books, but almost. So he had that in him, and as I say, he had a lot of different publications and letters and things, some of which are quite charming. He has his diaries as well. That was recently published in 10 volumes. Just a transcription of his diary. The man liked to write.
Well, no television, no radio, no interruption to your thinking, and
right,
a lot more time for reading and reflection. So I think the Victorians were, and also they had more leisure time than a lot of other periods. They just, of a certain class, they seemed to be able to turn out a lot of words.
This is true. He also, he was a working man. He was a lecturer at Oxford, so he had, air lessons and so on.
And he had his mathematics, although I did read Gardner's, or maybe it was somebody else, saying that he wasn't a brilliant mathematician. He was okay.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. He was, on the upper end, but not earth-shattering. He did write one of the first popular recreational math books. He did a lot of work on symbolic logic. He did some cryptography. He did a lot of magic tricks, things like that. So he just has one of these incredibly creative minds that almost anything he touched would turn golden.
Yeah. Well, maybe it makes sense that Martin Gardner would be so attracted to Carol, because in that way they were similar. It makes sense.
Absolutely.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. It's a beautiful book. I guess, as we're talking about it, we haven't really mentioned the physicality of it. It's a large, oversized book with beautiful reproductions of art and just... very rich. So not by no means a coffee table book. This, even though it's heavy as I'm holding it in my hand, not something that you could, necessarily read on the train, but it's definitely worth spending some time with. It's a really beautiful book.
Well, thank you. Yes, the 150th anniversary deluxe edition.
Deluxe,
big,
indeed.
Bright red cover.
Indeed. Very beautiful. Well, thank you, Mark, for spending some time with me. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Mark Burstein, who is the current editor, I will say, of the Annotated Alice, the 150th anniversary deluxe edition. Thank you so much.
A great pleasure.